That really is something. But on the Model Ts, you had to watch out for the kickback. You get your arm broken. Of course, I was always getting into trouble doing something or other. On the first Washburn Mill here near Forest Grove, lots of times night watchman would be cleaning up, and I'd go up there around the sawmill, and I'd put a little block, a little piece of wood, and then pull a trim saw on this little block, and the trim saw would pick this up, and it would just throw that little block way out there, oh, a couple hundred feet sometimes, and go just like a bullet. Dad Sherman had a kind of a box built around the back part of the saw so that stuff like that wouldn't throw, because it was right out toward the road. And if somebody was out there, why, this thing would go just like shooting a bullet out there. Because you had no way of aiming it. And it never did kick back on me. But other fellows had to saw, say, a block that, say, they'd saw off a piece and it would kind of get down into this groove and they would, and didn't notice it or something. It could actually go clear around and come back at them. So it was kind of a bad thing. Like I say, Dad Sherman built this box around it, keep from throwing the stuff too far. And I'd not, I got kick out of knocking the boards off of the box. When I would put one of these little pieces of wood in there, why, it would reel a lot of force. Well, it had to be forced to go out there 100 or a couple hundred feet, and just like a bullet, it would knock these boards off of the back of this box. Dad Sherman got onto it, and he made me quit. He said, "Hey, it's too dangerous for you." He said, "It's lots of fun to play with it, maybe," but he said, lots of times the stuff will come back at you. And he said, I forbid you to do it anymore. So that put a kibosh on that little plaything. As I have said before, I'm too close to my subject. I don't explain it so that a person not knowing anything about it at all would get the idea. I jump over too many, don't explain things very well. So on the rest of this tape, I think I'll pick up the sawmill again. On all of the little mills that we had, we had a mill pond. The big thing in the mill pond was to wash the logs off. But another big deal was to see one man, or even a kid, when I was just a young fella, with a pike pole, you could move those great big logs around that you couldn't move around otherwise in the water. You just push them around wherever you want them. So that way, when the sawyer would ask for a certain size of log and a certain length of log, why, you could pick them out of a group of logs and pick out the ones that you wanted. But made it real handy. Later, of course, nowadays, why, you wouldn't be able to dam up a little creek, or even a larger creek. I think they still use rivers for some of their logs, but a little creek, you couldn't dam it up because they wouldn't let you. A lot of the mills now use Oh, more of a what they call a cold deck. Cold means it isn't moving. And they pile them up, and they use a forklift type unit, sometime with a kind of a hand deal that grab a log. Anyway, the forklift type of machine, and they put these various logs in various piles, and then when they want them, why, they just go get them. And that would mean then that in the sawmill, they wouldn't have this ramp from the water up to the log haul. They would just put the thing right onto the log haul, maybe have the log haul twice as big as we would in a sawmill, little sawmill, and probably with some chains on it, so that they could just pull whatever log they wanted toward the carriage. So that did away with the water entirely. Of course, we used the water because the logs would get so muddy in dragging them with a steam donkey. Why, you pick up mud and rocks and everything else. They needed to be washed off. So, but in the later logging outfits, they used a caterpillar tractor-like, and with what they call an arch. This arch was two big wheels with a kind of a U-shaped piece between them, and a line right up there in the center of the U-shaped piece. And they would pick that end of the log up. So actually, they only drug the back end of the log, so they didn't pick up hardly any dirt or other debris. So that kind of did away with having to wash the logs off. Some of the mills put in a washer when they had too much dirt on them, and a lot of them put on a barker. They would put a kind of like a big lathe. They would put it in there and turn this thing around, and they had some kind of a tool that would take the bark off, which, of course, then they used the bark for a plant fertilizer and so forth. You heard of that. You can still buy bark dust if you have a yard, want to put around on your yard. So that took care of that part. One fellow who listened to some of these pre-tapes said, "Hey, your numbers don't add up." "Why?" Said, "Well," said, "you talk about having a 5 or 6 diameter log, and you only have a, well, to make numbers easy, we'll say you only have a 4-foot saw. Well, that means that you can only cut, well, and including the mandrel or the whatever it's fastened on to the shaft with, you lose about 8 inches. So that would only leave 40 inches, and 40 of the inches were on the other side of the saw. So you only have 20 inches to use. So that would mean that you couldn't saw. And of course, then you have the top saw, and it was really smaller than that. So, but hey, your numbers don't add up. You only have about, 40 inches of saw here, and here you got 60 to 72 inches of log. Well, the secret is that you don't cut the log down through the center. You cut them off the side. So naturally, you get the log on your carriage and you cut off all you can off of that side, and then you turn it. And every time you turn it why the thing gets flatter. So you finally get the thing, all the bark off from it, and here you've got a great big, what they call cant. Any time that had all the bark off of a log, and it was more or less square, that was called a cant. Now, I spoke about the nigger being in the middle of the log hall. It would reach up and turn the logs with the bark on them. But that was really too hard. It would cut the lumber up too bad if you used it on the cants. So they had what they call a cant gear. It was a pulley type with a chain hanging down in the middle of the mill there, on the middle of the carriage, and sort of a hook on it. He could hook it onto the side of a cant and lift it or turn it over, whatever he wanted to do with it. That is called a cant gear. So, I think I got him straightened out on the saw business. However, I did know that at times, why the log would be so big that it would hit the top part of the top saw center and not go by. And they'd have to do a little chopping to get it by that top flange there on the saw. So that took a little time too. When I first started these tapes, I used a 60 tape and I thought, well, that'll be all. But here I'm on the fifth tape and I'm not finished yet. One thing, Dad Sherman got a hold of what they call a splitting gun. It was just like a round piece of pipe, turned out of a good piece of steel, like, and hollow in the center. And I never did use it. Dad Sherman used it, and he didn't want anybody around when he was messing with it. I don't know whether he put the gunpowder in it first before he drove it in the log, or whether he drove it in the log and then put the gunpowder down through the center. I don't know. Anyway, it would split the log lengthwise. Say you had a log that was too big to go on the carriage or something. Why, he could split the log lengthwise. However, I don't think that was very good. It spoiled too much lumber. Nowadays, they would use a chainsaw and saw a little slab off of one side or the other if the log was too big. I see in some of the catalogs, they have a little sawmill for, a little farm, whatever, had a little timber like they wanted to cut up. And they have a little carriage like to shove back and forth. I think you shove it by hand. And then they have the chainsaw set up on a frame like, and the log into a kind of a frame too, so it won't twist. And in that manner, saw off their slabs or whatever onto these. Of course, probably they wouldn't use a log more than about 2 feet through at the most. the chainsaw are long enough to handle it. So anyway, it's kind of interesting to look at some of that newer stuff they've got out now. As I said before, being the boss's kid and so forth, I did everything in the sawmill. The only job I didn't in the little sawmill didn't do was figure out how much lumber I was going to get out of a certain log. I pulled the carriage back and forth a number of times, And lots of times when the sawyer would need to go somewhere for a minute or two, why, he would get the cant all fixed up, and then the ratchet setter, the fellow who shoved the log out every time, he knew just how much to or what they were going to cut out of the cant. So all I did was just pull the carriage back and forth. Well, now that's kind of like the donkey engine. If the fellow who rode on the carriage, the ratchet setter, couldn't even see me, he would know that there was somebody different. Everybody handles a lever a little different than the next fella. So he would know there was somebody else or somebody different on the pulling the through the law the carriage by the saw. I get too long-winded. I see that I'm getting down near the end of this tape, and I haven't even got you through the sawmill yet. I'm still talking about the carriage, and I haven't even got to the head-off bear yet. So have a good evening. And this will be tape number 6 of the One Kid Sawmill. I've spent quite a time making these tapes. I hope this is the last one. Seems like I keep thinking up more incidents, stuff that happened, and so forth. I've started these tapes way long in last century. But this is March the 1st, 2001. So on the last tape, I brought up a lot of safety, and I started in telling a little bit about the sawmill. I got to the point where I was talking about the carriage. The man on the carriage was quite an important man. Like, he was called a ratchet setter. Now, a good ratchet setter could help a sawyer quite a lot, in that he could, or he did, see when you wanted to cut a 2-inch plank, you say, off of a cant. Why, he'd set the thing out 2 inches plus the cut of the saw. See, if you didn't do that, if you just set it out 2 inches, why, the cut of the saw would make that board thin. It wouldn't be 2 inches. So you had to set it out 2 inches plus the cut of the saw. And over a whole cant, that was quite a deal to have it come out nice and even. The last two planks you'd get out of it, you'd actually split a 2 by 4.5 like in two, and that would make two 2-inch planks plus the one saw cut. So that was quite interesting in how to do that. I didn't like to ride the carriage. It made me dizzy. But I did a little bit. Most of the time, though, I'm going to get ahead of myself here a little bit. Most of the time, and all the time that I rode the carriage, everything was all set up for me. All I had to do was, when the carriage come back from cutting a board off, started down toward the saw again. All I had to do was hit this one button, and the power-driven head rig there would shove it out the 2 inches plus the saw cut, so that all I had to do was just hit this button, and things would happen. So, of course, by the time we got the one cant sawed up, why, the ratchet setter would be back by that time. So, like I say, I didn't like to ride the carriage much. But now I should explain a ratchet. In most of the later mills, why the movement of the blocks, head blocks, on the carriage was done by power. One of the last ones that I worked in, I didn't work on, I was an electrician. I worked, we had a drop cord like strung up on a wire, and that gave power to the carriage. And as the carriage went back and forth, it would either pull this wire up or string it out. And that worked pretty good. Had to replace the rubber drop cord, though, periodically, because in all that movement, it would actually wear someplace and make a disconnection. But the one I speak of just hitting the button, that had a rope-type belt on the outside of the carriage that run all the time, and the ratchet setter, all he had to do was just hit the clutch-type button and shove it out, or shove it, open it up, or shove it out, either way that he wanted to do it. But now, in the early days, I think the first four or five sawmills that we had, the ratchet setter had to do it by hand. Now this ratchet was a wheel on this screw shaft that pushed the head dogs back and forth, and it had notches in it, and then you had what they called a dog, just a piece of metal hanging down there, and you had this a crowbar or handle, and hooked onto one end, and this little piece of metal would ride on these cogs or bumps or whatever you want to call it on this shaft, and when you would push down on the lever, it would actually ratchet that small segment as far as it would go, and by doing that a number of times, you could actually turn this shaft. And an ordinary man, probably even a kid like I was, why, I could have moved about the biggest log there was in the on the carriage by this ratchet business. It gave quite a tremendous power ratio there. And so, well, and in the original sawmills where the ratchet setter had to do this, the ratchet setter was one of the main people in the sawmill. Of course, setting the ratchet was not his only job. See, when you rolled a log onto this carriage, why, you had to have some way of fastening it down, or what they call dogging it down. It had some system there to tighten it up onto the head rig blocks so that it wouldn't roll. So that was a ratchet setter's job too. So he would pull the head block back as far as, see that he could see what the next log was going to be. And he could pull it back as far as he thought he needed to. And then when the log rolled on, why, he'd dog it down. And then the sawyer would generally motion to him, say put up two fingers or four fingers or whatever, 2 inches, 4 inches, whatever, and he would ratchet it out that far, and he'd saw off that slab. Well, generally they would saw off another slice off from it, and with bark on both sides. But when he got the log back, why, he would undog it, and generally the sawyer had the choice there of the nigger or the cant gear, but generally the first couple of turns, he'd just fire the nigger up, and the nigger would put it flat side down. Then the ratchet setter would have to dog it down again, go back and set the ratchet out, whatever they wanted to cut off from it. Now, in some of the faster ones where they had what I've referred to as a shotgun feed, in other words, it had the carry just going back and forth, just boom, boom. Lots of times they would have either two or three men on the carriage. One, the ratchet setter, and maybe two more fellas on the dogs, because the ratchet setter didn't have time enough to, with that shotgun feed, time enough to do all that. So lots of time on the bigger, some of the mills there, like I say, there was three on the carriage, two doggers and the ratchet setter. Now I think most of that is automated, like, so you don't have to worry about too many men on the carriage there. I believe that pretty well explains the carriage and ratchet setter. Now, this is a job I liked in a little sawmill, because I had plenty of time to do it and everything, was the head-off bear. He was the fellow that was just on the other side of the saw from the sawyer, and he had a type of hook-type handle deal that he hooked on to the slab wood and pulled it down flat. Well, when they got into going pretty fast, they had to have these live rolls there going pretty fast. So, it kept them pretty busy there, just straightening out the lumber as they come through the saw, and routing it either to the edger or, in those faster mills, all of the slabs just went into a conveyor, and that went directly into the hog, and then on to the boilers for to make steam. So that got to be a pretty fast job there too. Like I spoke before, Dad Sherman never liked to drive. I could drive the old Model T, or I think we had a Page Detroit at that time with a gear shift, and I could drive either one of them very nicely. So lots of times, in the fall of the year or in the spring of the year, when the weather was nice, he would go out and maybe cruise through a bunch of timber, or go over and at the sawmill that was running and see how they were doing things and see if he could improve anything. And this one time, I think we went to Willamina, down here toward the coast. Took an all day trip down there and didn't stay too long. And the reason I'm bringing this up is they were cutting what we call Jap squares. These were logs that they would take the bark off of all four sides of them, and they didn't really worry about what size they were, because in the Orient they were using a metric system anyway, And so it didn't have to come out to, if we cut them to a certain inch here, well, that didn't fit what they were doing over there. So they just cut the bark off of all four sides. And in this particular day, we were down there. They were cutting these Jap squares. It was a fairly fast carriage. They had two doggers and the ratchet setter, and they were just pushing these things out, just one right after another. In talking to the owner, I think it was, he had three carloads of Jap squares to get out. They just loaded them on flat cars, and of course they had stakes around them to hold them. And but they were running these right straight out there. The flat car was right off the end of the rolls. And they had a kind of a gin pole there with some tongs, and they'd hook onto this thing and pull her, put it right around where they wanted it and set it down. And he was saying that, I think at the time we were there about 11 o'clock or something like that, I think he had one car almost loaded, and he said he needed to have three car loads by 4 o'clock when the train to come pick him up. So he was going to make it, too. Man, those things were coming out there. The big trim saw just barely having time to get both ends cut and shove it on out. And he kept those, the mill kept the loaders real busy putting those Jap squares around. Another similar incident, I never did see it done with the Jap squares. I seen it done with ordinary lumber. Up here along the River Columbia River Gorge, up on the plateau there, they would have a sawmill up there, and they had these flumes, this V-shaped watering trough-like, that the water run down, and they would put the lumber in that and turn some water on and shove it clear down to along the river where they had, say, in this one case, it had a planer down there. But these Jap squares kind of brought to mind the fact that we knew about one outfit that made the cants up above, and then they shoved them into the flume, and it had enough water. Of course, the flume was V-shaped, so that these cants fit it real good. And the water would shove them clear down to along the Columbia River. And they had a resaw down there. And they did the resaw work down there. So that's some more logging, flume logging. One fellow who was listening to these tapes, he said, hey, what's the difference between a Jap square and a cant? Hey, what's the difference between a Jap square and a cant? He said, you got the bark off of all of them, or both of them, and more or less squared up. Said, what's the difference? Well, there's quite a little difference, all right. The Jap square, you made just as big a square. It didn't have to be square either. Bark off of all four sides. So there wasn't any bark or what they call wane where the bark was, any distance there. That it had to be real good timber, all four sides. So that made the Jap square. One reason for the Jap square not being, say, a 12 by 12 or some particular size in inches, they used the metric system in the Orient. And so that if we cut it to a certain inches, why, that would be an odd number of centimeters that they had to work with. So we just cut as much, we left as much good timber as possible on the Jap square. Now on the cant, why, you figured what you wanted to cut out of this cant. Say you were cutting a 2x12s planks. You'd make the cant 12 inches on the one side, like, so that the top and bottom, say, was a 12-inch space. Then you cut the other side of the cant so that it would be just so many, say now like six, 2x2-inch pieces, making 2x12, plus the saw cut. So that the last cut you made would just cut, say, a piece of about 4.5, cut it in two, so it actually made two 2x12s. So that's the difference. Your cant was something that had already been figured out for the resaw to take care of. As long as we're talking about large pieces of lumber, you might say, cants and Jap squares, why, comes to mind that a friend of mine here just recently spoke about a sawmill down up in the hills there from Monroe in southern Oregon that have some old-growth trees, and they specialize in big, heavy timbers. If a person, the architect, say in a large room, why, he would want to say a 10x16, maybe 50 feet long or whatever length, why, they would cut these special pieces of timber out for those people who wanted something like that. Lots of times they would have to use two flat cars. It'd be too long for one flat car, and they would have to use two flat cars so that the flat cars, one flat car kind of just idles and allowed the thing to go around a corner. In telling these stories, I try to keep them bunched together. But I got one here I just thought of in the last couple days. It probably should have been placed in safety or in steam, in that there at the first Washburn Mill, where the planer was down there, I think a couple of blocks from the mill, the lumber piled in between the mill and the planer, and they had a steam line running down there and a little steam engine down there to run the planer. Also had a big blower. It would suck the shavings up off of the planer and blow them up to the boiler, so the planer shavings burned kind of fast and made good hot fire and made a lot of good steam. So and I think I was off bearing from the planer at the time, and I think we were running the running a 2x4 random, I mean 2x4 all kinds of lengths, and probably mill run two, all the, not all the same grade. just to loading the car, the 2x4s come right out on a roll right into the boxcar where I could place them. Well, I'm getting back to our iron. We didn't have good iron or good steel for a lot of our cutting things. This time, the planerman was either changing knives or adjusting, I don't know just which. There was some, on this blower, there was some pipes that come down, and you could raise these pipes to work underneath them. And I was watching the planerman and not paying too much attention. I got too close to one of these suckers and it pulled my hat off, a cap. And I thought, that's gone. The planer shavings would go right into the boiler, right into the hot fire. Oh, that's gone. So I didn't even go up to the boiler to see if I could retrieve it or anything. I think noon hour I was up there, and I looked, and hey, here was my cap sitting, hanging over there on a peg, had a burn spot in it about the size of the big old silver dollars. It had, on this chute, it kind of being flat, well, it floated out onto to the hot floor of the firebox and just burned a place in it. The fireman said, hey, I was watching very close to see whether the rest of you had come through. Well, if you got caught in this in any of these planers, these rolls that were shoving the wood through the whatever size you had, say you were running 2x4s, you would make a real good 2x4 out of you right quick, and that wouldn't been any fun at all. I just thought I'd put it in here at this time, explaining just a little bit why the fireman had no way of knowing that the planer was not in operation at the time. So I think it kind of gave him quite a little of a start there to find that hat come through waiting for the rest of me. Getting back to the Jap squares, I got away from the sawmill business in the 30s. I started my electrical career, and I worked 35 years as a journeyman electrician, retiring in 77. So, while I did some electrical work in the sawmills, well, I got away from them as far as doing anything around the sawmill. I understand that the Jap Square business had been outlawed, the laws against, when you figure it out, you can put almost twice as much lumber in ordinary boat ship to the Orient if it's nice and square, and I think they're still allowing some round logs to be shipped, but I think they even have a quota on that. I'm hoping that this will be the last tape. I've got this other side though to fill, which I won't have any trouble, I don't think, doing. The mind seems to be a wonderful thing. You think of something, and then before you get that really done real good, you think of something else, maybe entirely different. So I've got these tapes kind of mixed up. Every now and then I'll go off into left field on them. However, the material is all good. I I'm kind of thinking that somebody might take a notion, some writer might take a notion to write a book on this tapes. That way, they would probably put all the things together that were supposed to be of one particular kind. So, on the end of this tape, I think I shall try and give you some dates when I can come on to the scene. I remember back in about 14 or 15. See, I would have been 4 or 5, and apparently Dad Sherman and his brother Keeley, I don't know whether Ed had ever connected with it at that time or not, that would have been the brother-in-law, had some sawmills before that. I knew they had one at Warren, because when we built the house, I got the job of, I must have been 7 or 8 at that time. I got the job. Now that job was to dig out. There was a kind of a mound there, fairly close to the house. Dig out all the old bricks. It was out from the old firebox of one of the, call it the first sawmill at Warren, where we were building the house. I dug out enough bricks and rubbed them together till I got most of the mortar off of them to build a chimney for our house. That was probably in about 1918. I intended on this tape to get it kind of history, some dates started out. So apparently Dad Sherman and his brother had this sawmill at Warren and one or two sawmills in the Yankton-Trenholm area just out of St. Helens there before I came onto the scene or before I remembered. So in about 1914 or 15, why they had this mill at Holton, which is just out of St. Helens. Then from Holton, in about 16 or 17, they built the second mill at Warren, up this little creek up there. I speak about watching the steelhead run and getting into trouble there. That burned up in about probably the latter part of 1919, and then we made connection with Nebraska Bridge and built this sawmill at Olequa. Now Olequa is halfway between Portland and Seattle. I think it's still there, just a whistle stop. But I went to school there. I should say that while we were at Warren, I went to Bachelor Flat. I didn't get to go till I was 7 years old, so that would have been 1917. And but when we got over to Olequa, I think I was in the third grade. So, at Olequa, see, on these sawmills, you did what you could sell good. Our sawmill at Olequa, like I said before, we were connected with Nebraska Bridge. They built bridges in the west there, Midwest, Central. And we could sell them all of the planks. We sold them all the planks we could make. Of course, there was some side lumber left. Lots of times, see, these were the days when you did most everything with a team of horses. So fellows would come there with their wagon and get 2x4s and 2x6s and siding and shiplap. Shiplap is something you don't see anymore. It was used originally for a lot of subsiding. Now particle board is used almost entirely. That would be from about 1920 to about 1925 at Olequa. So we cut the timber out. So that was all there was. We sold the mill to Alaska Junk Company. And we lived there at Warren. We moved over to Warren at where we had the house, and some farmed a little bit. We had, I think, 2 cows and 2 horses, and about 40 acres of cleared land. Then I think it was Uncle Keeley found this mill at Washburn. At Washburn we had, that was up above Gales Creek out here from Forest Grove. When we moved over there, while we lived in Forest Grove, and the company was made up of Sherman Stanwood. Dad Sherman, Kaylee, his brother, and the brother-in-law, Stanwood, Ed Stanwood. I mentioned earlier that he had been sheriff of Columbia County at one time. I'll have to tell a couple of stories on Ed Stanwood. Ed Stanwood, nice gentleman. Like I say, people liked him. He was sheriff of Columbia County there. I think in about 1915, plus or minus a few. I don't know how long. But he was an atheist. He didn't believe in a hereafter-like. And as a little kid, I used to get a big kick out of it. We would carry our lunch, and at dinner time, he'd get clear up on top of something. Clear up on top of a pile of lumber, or if there was a stepladder around or something, he'd get up on top of the stepladder and eat his lunch. He said he was going to be far enough down when he died, 6 feet under. Well, I don't know. He might have reneged on that, because he married a nice lady there. Actually, she was my school teacher at one time. So he might have repented. I don't know. Another story, this is part of his, he told this himself, of his being sheriff. The fingerprint kits and so forth were just coming out, how to fingerprint and how to do this, and identify people by their fingers and so forth. The Columbia County bought him a fingerprint kit or outfit, and he read it all over like, I thought that one didn't amount to anything. But he had a group there that come to him and said, hey, somebody broke into my piggy bank and took the money out of it, a little over $10 in it, I think, or something like that. Of course, $10 then It was almost as good as 1,000 now, in that if you had a good job, most of the jobs were farming and so forth. If you had a good job and you made $1 a month plus your room and board, why, you were doing good. So I say that a little over $10 was about as good as 1,000 now. So he lined them all up from the family there and the neighbors and whatnot, and he proceeded to fingerprint all of them, and he went down through there. Didn't say much. When he got down to this little boy, he thought it looked like a kid had broke into it. Got down to this little boy, and it, oh, and little kid, oh, don't take me to jail. Don't take me to jail. I'll work. I'll pay it back. I'll pay it back. But don't take me to jail. Of course, the fingerprint had nothing to do with it at all, but the little kid got scared. Well, that's quite a story anyway. In this first Washburn Mill, this Sherman Stanwood, Ed Stanwood, he was our sawyer most of the time. We put out mainly railroad ties. Of course, in the summertime, why, I worked on, I think, every job in the mill, in that mill, except figuring out what to cut out of a log, like the sawyer does, or run the planer. Those two items I didn't do. I piled lumber, I piled slabs. Like I said, one of the worst jobs way along in some of the other tapes, I didn't like the being a fireman and engineer, run the engine and keep the boilers fired up. I was too much setting for this kid-like. I like to be out doing something and trying to figure out if I got too much sawdust in, I killed a fire and the steam went down and then I was in trouble. all kinds of things around the firebox. It's really quite an art to being a fireman, keeping the steam up just the right amount and the fire just the right amount and everything. So, I spoke about bulk of our was railroad ties. I also, that was the same mill where I took the lumber inspector, tie inspector to town. And we had the flat tire, and we patched it with postage stamps. That's a tall story, too. Of course, in that mill, I like to run the steam drag saw, Pond Monkey, and come to think about it, that was the only steam drag saw that we had in all of the mills, just that one. But anyway, it really did the job. Of course, now we run pretty much into the winter, and every Saturday, I had a job. We had one or two Seventh-day Advents, and they wouldn't work on Saturday. I'd take their job, whichever one it was that they were working on that Saturday, and then they would be watchmen on the Sunday. I don't know how long we run that particular mill. About 4 years, something like that. Around 29 and 30 burned up. I'm not just sure what happened when that burned up. The mill at Warren that burned up, the watchman left. So I told about that earlier. But I don't remember what happened to this particular mill. The second Washburn mill, of course, burned too. But in about 35 or something like that, the forest fire there come right across it and took it with it. Took everything down to Gales Creek. So that ended that up real quick. Every now and then I get way ahead of myself, which I did at that time, about it burning. When the first Washburn Mill burned, of course we had been incorporated, I think, the Sherman Stanwood Lumber Company, the two brothers and the brother-in-law there, Harry, Kaylee, and Ed. When that first Washburn Mill burned, I don't know what Ed went to do. He went to do something else. But Kaylee went to work for Pope and Talbot down in St. Helens. His wife's folks lived in St. Helens and had a house there in St. Helens. So he went back to St. Helens. One time when we visited them, he took us to all through the Pope and Talbot Mill there right by the city. And then also we took a little lunch and took us out to an island mill, showed us around. At that time, the Swedish gang type saw were just coming in, and he was showing us all about the Swedish gang and how it operated and so forth. And that was real interesting. When we took over the second Washburn Mill, which I said just burned here just a few sentences back, of course, Kaylee and Ed had left, so we formed a new company, and Dad Sherman was president of the company, and Mom was a vice president, and I was secretary treasurer. Had to have three names on there, so I was secretary treasurer. I didn't have nothing to do. So I, as a kid, I thought, hey, I really got a title. We, in that mill, we put out a lot of railroad ties. It was, this first Washburn Mill was only about a 20,000 board feet a day, 8-hour day. This was about a 40,000. It was about twice as fast as that first mill. I never did very much. I did some pond monkey on the second Washburn Mill, but mainly I run the planer. I've told about that quite extensively in an earlier section, and my big name to fame was the three silos that we cut out for them. We cut a lot of special work any time that that, like I say, that was a pretty large mill, and if I remember right, most of our mills only had two head blocks, and they were probably about 8 to 10 feet apart, something like that. But I think this mill had three. I think they could cut up to about 24, or maybe by stretching it a little bit, they could cut a big timber or something about 30 feet long by kind of taking it easy and so forth. We did a lot of that special work. It took a trailer to... most of our lumber, of course, went by rail. But we had a loading dock there where the people would come and get all kinds of finished lumber and so forth. We run that mill till 34, 35, along in there, something like that, when it burned up. A lot of the time I didn't work in it very much. I had taken my first electrical license out in 30, and by 34, 35, I was pretty much working full-time as an electrician. So when it burned, my job didn't end. I had my own job. Dad Sherman then went to work for, I can't just remember. He worked for Stimson's Lumber Company on the pond, and he worked for Carnation Lumber Company on the pond. See, to have an old sawyer, Dad Sherman used to do a lot of sawing when he was had our own mills. Boy, to have a sawyer picking logs out for him, the sawyer really liked that because he could pick out logs and kind of get them even, like, so he didn't have to do an awful lot of figuring on them all the time. So they like to have an old sawyer be pond monkey. Yeah, that ought to be enough times and dates of the Sherman sawmill. I never did finish the sawmill up. I got, to the head-off bearer. He was on the other side of the saw from the sawyer, and he would take the slabs. Like I spoke, in some of the bigger mills, the slabs would go into a conveyor right there, right quick, and head for the hog. Of course, the ones with bark on both sides, why he had to move over to the edger for the edger man to cut the edges off from the, make a good board. Now, in the small mills, why, we just had what they called a large trim saw, a small trim saw. The large trim saw, of course, would cut the tuba 12s and ties and that type of stuff, and the small trim saw would take care of the tuba 4s and all the 1-inch stuff, and the trimmings from the various boards that had come through the edger, those edgings that were bark on them and so forth. And in one mill, when I run the small trim saw, I had a little cart that I put those edgings on, and took them out to a little place where I burned them and dumped them and burned them. So, but now in the bigger mills, that would be too slow. The bigger mills, they had the edgings, and all of the lumber come out to what we called a green chain. First part, they would come out to a kind of a sorter. A fellow would be standing there, and he would dump the edgings and all the unsaleable lumber, and slabs into the conveyor to go on out to the hog. Now, there's a chain. Now, these chains, you think of a chain as round links. these chains around the sawmill were flat. They were kind of a U-shaped deal with a pin on the end and hole on the other, and you could just put as many of them together as you wanted to. They were necessarily flat so that when they run in this conveyor, they would take small stuff like sawdust right with them, and that way keep the conveyor clear, as well as the slabs and edgings. So now that green chain, it run, say, 90 degrees to the mill. As the lumber come off of the chain, off of the rolls, it would go onto this chain, and I say this sorter would take out all the junk. Then the regular lumber, ties and so forth, would go over to this gang trim saw. This trim saw had about, 6 or 8 saws on it. And power operated, of course. All he had to do, if he wanted to make a piece of board 10 feet long, why, he'd trim the front end of it off with one saw, and he'd hit the 10-foot button, and the 10-foot saw would come down, and this chain would pull it by the saw, and you'd have a 10-foot piece of board. So he had that whole thing, all those boards to trim as they came through. Then they come down a little ramp and turned over. Now the reason for this coming down this little ramp and turning over was that there was a grader where a person stood there and he figured out how many knots and how good a grade this was. When we